Welcome to Muffliato, a Harry Potter podcast where we fill your ears to prevent you from hearing nearby conversations. I'm Josh.
And I'm Blake, and today Peter has been a naughty rat as we continue our journey through Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban and come now to the 19th chapter, The Servant of Lord Voldemort. Now, Josh, I think many fans have thought about this, and it's mentioned in the book that Peter Pettigrew has been chilling out with Ron for the past 12 years. Kind of slightly creepy, don't you think?
Long time. Yeah.
Like, just kind of weirds me out.
Yeah, well, and we need to remember that, you know, it's not like he was hanging out with Ron for all 12 of those years, but he was hanging out at Hogwarts for most of those 12 years, probably with Ron somewhat in the summers.
Yes.
But this guy has been staying with Weasley brother after Weasley brother in the Hogwarts dormitories for a long time.
Yeah, it's just kind of like a strange thing. You know, you can't help to think like, you know, I think Ron says it in this chapter, right? Like, you know, I let you sleep in my bed, you know, and it's just like,
yeah.
It's just that great. You, for the longest time, you've just shared a beard with this grown man in the form of a rat.
This murderer, right?
that's so true. It's very strange, but like very to the character of Peter Pettigrew and how he wouldn't actually murder them until he got something out of it himself, knew that Voldemort was like coming back to power and then he could be there to strike and stuff. But apart from that, it's not like he had any inherent desire in himself to like be like, yeah, Harry Potter needs to die, right? Like, what does he get out of that? You know, whereas I'm sure if it was Bellatrix Lestrange chilling out in rat form, the first moment she could get, she would probably, you know, change back and be like, you know, Avada Kedavra, done, you're dead, you know, and that's it. Like, because she relishes in that murder. Whereas I feel like, yeah, for Peter Pettigrew, it is more just what he gets out of it, you know, being protected by like someone powerful like Voldemort, being able to be useful and present himself as a useful person, as a faithful servant, whereas like he's not going to break cover to just to kill Harry. He's got a comfortable life in a way, but as well as he's hiding from the other Death Eaters so that he doesn't get in trouble for killing off his old boss.
Yeah, but I think in the end, as we see, Voldemort is ultimately happy that Harry has survived in the Goblet of Fire, because he is able to use some of his blood. He's able to, he thinks, take his own revenge. But, you know, that ends up being something for which Voldemort isn't exactly disappointed. So maybe we can be thankful for a couple reasons that it was someone like Pettigrew and maybe someone a little less crazy like a Bellatrix Lestrange.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Blake, it's a long summary today. A lot happens. We kind of have these two chapters, this one and the next. This one, a very long chapter with a lot of dialogue, a lot of explanation. And then the next one with some level of action, but very short. So
yes,
bear with us. This is a long summary, but a lot happens. As he enters the Shrieking Shack, Professor Snape explains that while bringing Lupin his Wolfsbane potion, he stumbled upon a special map on his desk. This, combined with the invisibility cloak he found by the Whomping Willow, allowed him to arrive unannounced. Snape believes that Lupin is helping Black, and therefore binds him before Lupin can explain. The trio demand that Snape allow for an explanation, but when he refuses, they together disarm him, who, as a result of the Triple Force spell, is knocked out. With Snape temporarily out of the way, Ron hands Scabbers to Lupin, who, alongside Sirius, begins to explain how Ron's pet could possibly be Peter Pettigrew. Sirius explains that he recognized his old friend in a photo of the Weasley family visiting Egypt. Scabbers' missing toe confirmed his identity for Black, explaining that Peter cut off his finger to fake his death as he confronted Sirius about Lily and James. Lupin adds to the evidence by stating that Scabbers has lived far longer than any normal rat, although he now looks unwell. Thinking back to the start of Scabbers' illness, Harry realizes that it fits perfectly with the news of Black's escape. Sirius also shows how Crookshanks immediately recognized Pettigrew for an animagi. With some persuasion, eventually, the cat also worked with Sirius to get the passwords to Gryffindor Tower. As Sirius makes the final moves to kill the rat, Harry questions Black that, regardless, he is still guilty for the deaths of his parents. Sirius reveals that it was Pettigrew, not him, who betrayed them, although he still blames himself for trying to outsmart Voldemort and failing. Lupin casts a transformation spell on the rat, and a very rat-like human emerges. Pettigrew explains that he feared for his life after the Potters died, thinking that Black would come for him next. Black corrects him, saying that it was Peter who was the secret keeper. His only defense now is that he has not attacked Harry for 3 years, even though he had opportunity. Black finally reveals how he managed to escape Azkaban, how his innocence kept him sane, and how his transformations into a dog allowed him to be less affected by the Dementors. When he finally saw Peter in the photo, he knew he needed to act and was able to escape in his dog form. Harry is convinced that this indeed is the truth, and Peter admits to serving Voldemort. As Lupin and Sirius make a move to kill him together, Harry intervenes, invoking his father's memory to stop them. As they prepare to go back to the castle, Lupin splints Ron's leg, levitates Snape, and shackles Pettigrew. Crookshanks leads the procession out of the shack, immeasurably proud.
A long summary, yes, but definitely helpful, Josh, because I feel like this is that last chapter of expositional chapters of the three that we've been talking about for the, you know, this episode, obviously, in the last two episodes. And this really does finish things off quite well for that kind of exposition, for us to know background and know history to this point where Harry can now, you know, agree and actually be like, you know what, I believe what Sirius Black and Lupin are saying. And, you know, I just love how their like spells combine to like knock Snape out completely. If Snape didn't like Harry before, he's definitely not going to like Harry now.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. And I think like this is something that we see. This is probably our only world building of the chapter. So let's do it right here. Why do we not see this more often? Characters like combining together to like double and triple spell force. This is amazing. Yeah.
It's like, you know, I know some spells probably might not work together, but clearly some do, whether it be the duplicate of the, you know, the same spell over and over again, or like a combination of two spells, like that might form into be one mega spell. And you just think that is really helpful. And I feel like it's only the chivalry or whatever of like doing a duel where it's one-on-one because that's fair. But, you know, when you think about it, when you're versing like a Death Eater, things aren't going to be fair. So like if you can have three people like combine their spells to be like directed at a Death Eater, man, that's going to make a punch.
Yeah, I think this is fantastic, especially for these situations where these young teenagers are facing a fully trained wizard.
Yes.
It's pretty fantastic, pretty funny to see.
Yeah,
definitely. A moment of comic relief, even as Professor Snape is thrown backwards.
Yeah, you would imagine that whenever, you know, say in the time when Hogwarts is invaded, right, in Half-Blood Prince, in the books only, this is, you know, it's not shown in the movies, but, you know, you'd want people to go in pairs so that they can like almost more easily overpower the other wizards, right? Because they could kind of combine their magic together just to win over someone who might be a bit more proficient or have a bit more experience. So yeah, I think that's a wonderful little bit of world building that's there that's not actually utilized again, I don't think.
I'm not claiming to be as wise as Dumbledore, but why can't we just get 20 people together and all cast a spell at Voldemort? Like, it's no hurt in trying, right? Like,
but not the dumb maneuver. I don't know if this is actually in the fourth book or if it's just in the movie, but you know, when the Ministry of Magic turn up at the Quidditch mat, the World Quidditch Cup, and they're going after like the, you know, someone in the middle, like Barty Crouch Jr., they're all pointing their wands in the middle. And you just think, isn't that the dumbest layout to kind of all surround one person, point your wands at that one person? Because like, what if you miss? It just seems like the most stupid. It's like, line them up, you know, group them together, all 20 people firing a spell at, you know, Voldemort or a Death Eater or whatever. And surely you can't just, you know, Protego that and like create a shield. That would just be too powerful.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And you could just picture it where unlikely, but you know, that circle really turns into a death trap where all of a sudden Barty Crouch is left standing and everybody's eliminated the person across from them.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Or like someone quickly apparates in the middle and then all those spells fly into each other, create a bomb of magic or something and blows everyone away. It just seems, yeah, seems a little bit crazy. I mean, it looks great on film. Every, you know, you're surrounded, but like, yeah, it just seems, yeah, it seems a bit like it's not the most practical way of doing things. But how great, I mean, is this entrance from Snape, right? We obviously get that, you know, he's arrived at the very end, that lovely cliffhanger of the chapter, last chapter, but now he's here and he's kind of jumping to conclusions. He's, you know, not listening. You know, it wouldn't be in him to listen because of his hatred for the people in that room, that he thinks I know everything, I've got it all right. And he's not willing to listen, but Harry clearly is, as he kind of makes that decision in him to be like, I'm going to attack a teacher. So it's a pretty big moment for Harry to make that decision on behalf of, clearly it's made also by Hermione and Ron as well, but not sort of, they don't talk about it. But it's like, all of a sudden it's like, wow, they turn on Snape so they can kind of keep listening and finding out more things.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely the most out of character for Hermione.
Yes.
Harry probably needs little encouragement, but you know, this is still attacking a teacher. As much as he might hate him, you know, this is still a teacher.
Yeah, I would have thought that it almost would suit more if it was Ron and Harry that,
yes,
you know, yeah, and even their spells combined to make it quite powerful. Whereas Hermione was like, well, and then a little, you know, little one liner or a quip being like, well, he's still a teacher, you know, like something that could have been quite good. But when we come to the key theme, Josh, what sort of things do we see? Is there a key theme that kind of stands out among others, or is it sort of multiple? What do we see in this chapter?
Yeah, I'd say if we're going to have kind of a bigger theme, it would be truth and lies. But the key theme really is truth. This is the chapter where we find out that pretty much everybody in the wizarding world has been believing a lie about, yeah, Sirius Black and Peter Pettigrew. And so even in this chapter, as Peter Pettigrew tries to spin his web of lies a little bit further, the truth finally comes out and Harry finishes the chapter by believing Lupin and Sirius's story. But we need to remember, like, Lupin is realizing these things in almost real time. He has a little bit of a leg up on the students, but he is, he admits that he too believed the original telling of events as well.
Yeah, yeah. Lupin was definitely only maybe one pace ahead of Harry and the rest of them. He kind of, I think it's said at the end of this chapter, or close to towards the end, being, Remus asks forgiveness and Sirius asks forgiveness of each other, thinking that they were each the traitor or whatever, you know. Like Sirius feels bad that he couldn't trust Lupin, and Lupin's like, no, you know, forgive me for getting it wrong all this time. So they kind of, you know, reconnect through that, as well as Harry. So it really is all these people coming into that knowledge, right, of the truth.
Yeah.
This is what has happened. And Dumbledore comes into that knowledge pretty quickly and agrees the story, you know, agrees about the story with them. Like, he clearly had his suspicions and maybe thought when Sirius Black kind of went away, maybe he thought, I didn't think it would have been him, but okay, you know, like the evidence all points to it. And so when this story comes along, that's pretty believable, where it's like Peter Pettigrew, I think maybe, you know, Dumbledore, who would have known Pettigrew quite well, probably would have been like, you know what, that fits and I'll believe it.
Here's an interesting question, Blake.
Yeah.
Just thinking with my wizard forensics hat on, as they come to the death scene where Black was accused and where only a finger was found.
Yes.
Presumably, Pettigrew's wand would have dropped to the ground when he transformed to be a rat. And Black's wand would have been there. Why was no priori incantatum used in the case?
Yeah, I wonder if he destroyed the wand. Like, maybe he did say, remember, like, you think, because there was a big crater in the ground, right? That blew up, like he blew up behind him, explosion and stuff. And that's the sort of way that he jumped into the sewers. Because it obviously it would have been pretty convincing for Sirius Black to, you know,
But even you would have had his wand left.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
I think what we can learn from that is just how, you know, they find the finger and as a result, everybody believes Pettigrew's acting. You know, they believe his monologue at the beginning, accusing Black of doing it, and no one is willing to really ask the hard questions or investigate further. Like, the obvious answer just is shown to be what people believe, even though there are some things that are a bit odd. You know, such as the fact, you know, if we did have Pettigrew's wand, we would have been able to see that, you know, prior to the explosion, it was himself who cut off his finger, who used his wand to do that. Yeah.
That's actually a really good point. That's worthy of a sort of a, you know, extra thought that goes into those sorts of alternative sort of theories, being like, well, what does that mean? You know, does it, you know, back then was priori incantatum a popular spell, or was it not that, or was it not part of the ministry's like regulation of how they handle crimes? You know, that thing.
Yeah. Because we see that spell for the first time in the next book, I believe. Is that right? We see that with Barty Crouch Sr., right?
Yes, I think so. I think it doesn't come, you know, it hasn't been in play these first three books. I think, the fourth is when it is introduced as a new thing. So clearly not a new spell to the wizarding world, but, you know, new to us that we see that. So yeah, it's interesting, right? Like, it's clearly things that, little things like that might be overlooked by Rowling as she's writing. Like, you know, there is no one that knows the books better in a way than the fans, or like it's sometimes I feel like I've heard Rowling say this as a writer, like sometimes the fans know more in the sense of like of plot holes and things can be a bit they are more aware of those sorts of things.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, Blake, is that if we're going to just say that it wasn't a mistake or anything like that, we've seen time and time again that the ministry's attempts at justice are very flawed.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think we almost need no explanation. You know, my point was more one of, you know, they really overlooked the evidence rather than, you know, it's a mistake. But yeah.
I think that's probably what they did. They just overlooked the evidence, and they were too confident being like, okay, well, you know, clearly this is a thing and all these people died, but they all heard lots of witnesses to hear this story. So clearly there's nothing, you know, further that's going afoot here. Like, that's it, you know, and let's just lock them away. So, which is sad, right? It's not proper justice. It's that kind of quick and easy. We just need this matter settled. So the wizarding and the muggle world can go back to sort of normality, or kind of just the separation that's already there.
Yeah, definitely. Like, what character development do we see in the chapter?
Yeah, so Severus Snape is something that I noticed first was that he uses magic without a wand or incantation, right? Like, he's got that ability to have that. Now, that's a serious ability, right? That's something that takes a lot of focus and concentration. You know, Dumbledore can do it. There's other wizards that can definitely do it. But it's not like a normal thing that I feel like is taught at Hogwarts, right? There is non-verbal spells that I feel like taught at Hogwarts, where you've still got a wand, but, you know, non-verbal, it's a way that you can sort of not necessarily you could sneak up on your opponent, but also they don't hear you say Petrificus Totalus, and you kind of have to, like, they're already being like, okay, what's a good defense for that? Whereas, like, that's a non-verbal, whereas this is like no wand and non-verbal. So it's pretty impressive. You know, that non sort of verbal, the non-wand spell, that there was Snape using it to tie up Lupin. It was like shooting ropes out. And we also see that in the Philosopher's Stone with Quirrell shooting, you know, ropes up to tie up Harry as well. And so it's just a small little detail there about Snape. But, you know, later on, we do see that Snape has also that kind of power of flight, that you know, he has picked that ability up. He's you know, a competent wizard at, you know, occlumency, like all of these categories of hard magic. There's a wonderful Wizarding World article that I could put in the show notes that has some difficult levels of magic, and that's, you know, flight, occlumency, Patroni, like those are big things that are like pretty difficult to do. Non-verbal, non-wand magic, like all of that's on there. And Snape's pretty adept at it, right? Like he's clearly anything he puts his mind to, he's pretty good at. Like when it comes to potions, he's good at. But another thing that we see about Snape here is his very hot temper, right? Like he is just annoyed at this situation. He is so frustrated. He's angry. And he calls Hermione a stupid girl, which is like, you know, I'm assuming, Josh, you know, you're a teacher. I'm very close to, you know, being a teacher, but I'm pretty sure that you don't call your students stupid. And very rarely, this is one of those moments where you just think that is just nuts. Like he clearly is just not in his right state of mind, or is in his, in a way, but that's clearly not a good state of mind. And he calls Hermione a stupid girl because she's trying to reason, and she's, you know, and Snape just doesn't want to hear anything of it. So we see these sort of two sides, the powerful side, but also the very quick tempered and angry Snape as well.
Yeah, and I think like this is something that we don't really realize until this point in the books, is that there is another level to Snape's anger aside from his kind of snide comments and rudeness in the classroom. That his anger here, and then later, spoiler alert, his anger when Black escapes. This is kind of the bubbling over. Or the boiling over of a constant simmer that, you know, he is genuinely and generally frustrated with life, I feel like. Yes. But this is where it kind of just explodes out.
Yeah. Another bit of character development that we see that I think stands out quite a lot is Harry, and how when, you know, Snape's been, you know, knocked out, everybody's understood the situation, and Lupin and Sirius Black are like, they're ready to kill Peter Pettigrew. Harry steps in and doesn't want him to be killed. And, you know, Harry has every right, you know, according to them in that way, for, you know, to seek revenge. You know, he betrayed your parents, Harry. He was the one that pretty much killed them. He deserves this. And Harry steps in and just says, you know, like, no, right? Like it's that hard level of being like, Harry would have been facing two different almost presences, just being like, one being like, yes, like, you know, that would be satisfying, him to be gone, he killed my parents, you know, he sold them to Voldemort. But then that other side, which is just his, like, the reason why he is Harry Potter, such a good-natured kid, is that it is like, you know, that side prevails, right? And he actually doesn't want his best friends becoming killers. There's nothing that comes from that except instant revenge. Like as soon as he's dead, and Harry might have, you know, realized this, that's it. Like there's no witness, or there's no, like, you know, like there's just, you know, you want to be able to question someone when it comes to this sort of thing, so that Sirius Black can be, you know, declared innocent. And, but if Peter Pettigrew was dead, it's like, no, that ain't gonna help. So I think that's a really wonderful moment, that he actually doesn't want his best friend's dads to become murderers, right?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, Harry shows something here, which we see later on in a similar way with Dumbledore, who really wants the full truth to be exposed. You know, Harry is wanting to defend his godfather and his favorite teacher from becoming murderers. Mm. But he also knows, I think, intuitively, that if Peter doesn't come back with them, there's going to be some serious questions about what exactly happened. You know, Snape is knocked out, and Peter is needed for the ultimate reveal of the truth. And in the next book, the reason I mentioned Dumbledore is, you know, we kind of see that happening with Barty Crouch Jr., is that before he's able to really give testimony, you know, what happens, the Dementor's kiss is applied. And there's such a great loss there. And so, you know, there's this sense that the wizarding world is so quick to act sometimes that they really miss out on a full explanation of what's been going on. But Harry has that great instinct there. I think first, like you said, out of kindness, but then second, you know, out of a desire to hear the full truth explained.
And, you know, then it's like, he does sink a little bit into that darker Harry mode, where it's like, but then the Dementors can have him. You know, like it's kind of like that's almost what he deserves. Coming from a point that says, you know, Harry being like, whoa, you know, Sirius Black does deserve that, right? And that conversation he has with Lupin, and Lupin being like, does anybody deserve to have their soul sucked out? You know, like, is that, does anybody deserve that? And like that conversation there, clearly Harry is now being like, well, this guy does, you know, the Dementors can have him. I don't want that sort of that blood on my you know, my dad's best friends, and very kind of quickly becoming, you know, my sort of friends, acquaintances, sort of mentors in a way, like that's who they become and family. And it's like, I don't want them having that on their hands, right? Even though they're more than happy to.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Yeah, but like we've already mentioned the world building right at the beginning with the triple powered spell. Sounds like a commercial.
There's got to be some sweet name for that, right? Like triple power spell. Like
got to be.
Yeah, there's got to be some wonderful spell that's like can only be generated from the power three wizards or something. I don't know. Like there's you know, people make up those charms and those spells, right? Like they develop them in some way, and we don't see much of that process, which is pretty interesting how that's, you know, how spells are created. But, you know, when it comes to this, like surely there's got to be one where it's like, okay, to do this spell, you've got to have three people, and you know, all of this stuff happens, and then this magical spell comes out of their wands, and it's just it's like a powerhouse. But yeah, that would be pretty impressive. So that is kind of the main world building element that we see in this very kind of or finish of these expositional chapters.
Definitely. But moving on, we also see a pretty interesting literary device, Blake. And I don't know if this is you know, normally when we think of device, we think of something intentional, but this is a literary device that involves a mistake.
Yeah. So when looking into, you know, this chapter, there was quite a few things that jumped to my mind where people had mentioned that there were mistakes. And I was thinking like, you know, how big can mistakes be, right? Like there's always those famous mistakes on, I think, the first Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the outer cover, right?
The school list, right?
Yeah. Outer cover as well as the school list, you know, wand being repeated, I think it is. And yeah, so there's always those couple things, but this was one that I hadn't noticed before. And I know that I think in now the issues that we have and the editions of the book that we have now, this has been updated and changed. But in some of those first editions, it said that Voldemort's been hiding for 15 years. They say he's half dead. And that number should actually be 12 instead of 15. And it just kind of caught me. It was quite fun, but mainly, and I mention that to jump into what Harry Potter and some of the sort of the Wizarding World community call these mistakes, and they call them like flints. And the reason for why that it's called like a flint and why that's what they call a mistake in the books is that Rowling made an error when she left Marcus Flint in the story for one book too many. I think it was this book that he's in this book, Prisoner of Azkaban, when he shouldn't have been. It would make him an eighth year student in this book, which was surprising. And so when asked about this error, Rowling joked about it, saying he had to do the year over again, which I thought was pretty clever. But I think it's understood to
very
be,
believable.
Yes, it's for Marcus Flint, it's a very believable mistake, which I think is fun, right? Like that. Yeah. It's a fun thing that doesn't really break the story for you. It doesn't really ruin it or anything. I didn't even notice this one myself. I sort of was pointed this out by the name being like Flint. I was like, what is a Flint? Why do they call it that? And that's because Marcus Flint. So when there's an error in the books or something, they're often called Flint. So
I'd never heard of that.
Yeah. So that was pretty funny. Cause I was like, oh, where do I put this? You know, is this just an interesting fact? And I was like, you know what, this is that kind of relates to the literary, you know, device, or more like just the actual book in itself being like, you know, it would be so hard for her to keep track of all these students and the different years and the different Quidditch teams, you know? And so, man, I can understand them, like, you know, just her leaving them in, you know, Flint in to be part of the Quidditch team, and then just being like, oh, wait, actually, he wasn't meant to be. So yeah, very, very funny that this is, you know, there are those things in books that are big giant series. And I'd be interested to hear of any others, if our listeners do know of any ones that maybe aren't as popular of a mistake that people know, but let us know what those are. And aside from that, we obviously have our literary device of foreshadowing, which comes into play, I feel like, when it's the chapter title, right? Like this refers, the servant of Lord Voldemort kind of refers back to that prediction that Trelawney made.
Yeah. And I mean, like we've said so many times, really until this chapter is complete, we're thinking, okay, Sirius Black, he's going to go back to Lord Voldemort. You know, Harry doesn't believe him yet.
Yeah.
He's interested to hear the story, but so finally we find out that, okay, this is who it's going to be. And we see very quickly on in the next chapter, just how that escape takes place.
Yeah. And something, Josh, that I didn't realize is that the time traveling moment is only one chapter. Like,
yes, true.
I thought it was like a bigger part of the story than it actually was, right? Like, I feel like a few chapters ago, I was being like, all right, we're nearly ready to get into the time traveling. But I'm like, no, it's like the second to last chapter and that's it. Like, it really is just a quick retelling of the stories from a different perspective, them fixing some of these solutions. And it shocked me a bit that it really was just a quick part. But obviously that's, we see that later on in not next chapter, but the chapter after. And so, yeah, I think that's going to be quite exciting. And significance wise, anything other than I think that moment of belief that Harry has in Sirius and Lupin's kind of story and what they've had to say, anything else other than that Harry finally believes?
No, I think you've nailed it. That's the significance, is that the truth has come out and that Harry has now believed it.
Exactly. Well, thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're an Apple user, don't forget to leave us a rating and review. Your support helps keep the magic alive. You can send us a question on our Instagram or email, muffleautopodcast@gmail.com, or use the form on our website at www.muffleautopodcast.com. To continue the adventure, join us next time as we discuss the 20th chapter of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, The Dementor's Kiss.